I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
If more fiber and protein fit your New Year health goals, get better macros with Hero Bread. They have sliced bread, tortillas, bagels, and more with protein and high fiber. And there's 0 to 5 grams of net carbs and 0 grams of sugar. Hit your goals with easy swaps for your favorite bready dishes with 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code HERO26 at checkout. That's 10% off with code HERO26 at HERO.co. All figures per serving of Hero Bread contains up to 18 grams of fat per serving. Not a low-calorie food. See nutrition facts on hero.co.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, as you all know, if you followed this show, I'm a tiny bit optimistic about things like AI and robotics and so on. Now, you start to follow through the logic of what that does. At the moment, most economic activity is constrained, not so much by the amount of resources, but quite literally, it's by the amount of management oversight, the amount of intellectual bandwidth go into something. I've worked with many companies over the years, and that is ultimately tends to be the restraining factor on a lot of activity. After that, you've got the restraining activity, the restraint of the number of workers that you can bring in, people who can actually do the job. But with AI and robotics, it's not impossible that we could actually solve those two problems. If you do that, then the next logical step is that your constraint becomes the amount of resources available to you. And if you do that, then logically, the next major industry that we're not talking about at the moment, but we will be on the other side of AI and robotics, is going to be space, because that gives you access to the quantity of resources that you need to really take economic growth to an unlimited level. So given that logic chain, I've been wanting to speak to somebody who knows about space. And I'm delighted to say that I have found just the man, Grant Donohue, planetary scientist. Welcome to Brokenomics.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Good. Well, can you tell us about yourself? I mean, what is a planetary scientist?
So planetary science is a subfield of geology, which is an annoying term because geology specifically refers to the Earth. But I was trained as a sedimentary petrologist. Professionally, I've worked as both a petroleum and a environmental geologist. But more broadly, it means that I study the evolution of systems as the evolution of systems. We don't tend to say geology in isolation because we've discovered that there's an enormous amount of interaction between the lithosphere, the hydrosphere, and the atmosphere, that considering one without the others is simply not reasonable, both on Earth and on other heavenly bodies.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so you do Earth-based geology as well. I mean, that is probably helpful, because one of the things I was thinking leading into this is, well, how do planetary scientists get jobs? Because, you know, there can't be that much demand for it, given that we're not actually in space yet. But if you can do the geology bit as well, I guess you'll be going to be okay.
Yes. So there are a number of PhD programs, positions in academia, NASA, for example, who are looking into ISRU, a word I'm going to use a lot, in-situ resource utilization, for whom planetary scientists are of great interest, but that would be for someone who's more specifically focused on that. I'm a mere mortal, and the allure of the petrochemical industry and the greater opportunities there.
They pay well. Yes, got it. Right. Yes. But nevertheless, we can dream that, you know, 20 years down the line, there'll be real demand for the planetary side of your skill set.
Yes.
Getting to that point, where do you think we're kind of going to go first in terms of making use of space industry? Because I know there is I mean, there's obviously quite a bit of space industry at the moment with the satellite systems that we have going around. And I understand things are getting pushed in that direction more and more. So, for example, because there's so much data basically up there in the lower Earth orbit, firms are starting to realize that actually it's cheaper to send data centers up into Earth orbit and process the data there than it is to sort of bounce it all backwards and forwards all day. And once you start, you know, once you start pushing more and more the value chain up into orbit, well, then you've got a growing industry, and then it's natural at some point to go beyond that. So what do you think of the sort of the key drivers that are going to take us to make this a proper industry?
Well, so studying, there's a wonderful expression in geology, which was by Charles Lyon, who's along with Hutton considered the father of geologists. And he said, the present is the key to the past. And so what I think a principle we can extrapolate from that is that if we want to look at how we might expect the industrialization to play out of space, it might be useful to examine how industrialization played out or did not play out in the past. And so in that regard, I would say that where we are in space right now is similar to where the Romans were with the area pile, you know, the little thing that spun around, in that the engineering and the technology is there, but because of a lack of resources or contravening economic motives, you know, for the Romans, it was the fact that they had no real call for labor-saving devices. Labor was the one thing they had no shortage of. That did much to halt the advancement of that technology. There was no virtuous cycle that led to reinvestment and reinvestment and reinvestment. But by contrast, when industrialization did kick off in the United Kingdom and the Low Countries and eventually the rest of Europe, there were a series of factors that drove it, most principally when it comes to geology, coal. England and Wales have the most bountiful resources of anthracite in the world, more or less. High quality coal that burns incredibly cleanly. And it runs right to the surface. And so we've been extracting coal since the 16th century. Railways actually predate the steam engine by 200 years. And a lot of people made a lot of money mining coal around southern England. But one of the interesting things that affected that was that in Roman Britain, the main thing that limited mining was that you wouldn't exhaust the material seams, you'd reach the water table. And unlike many other applications where alternative forms of power like wind or water were appropriate, if you want to pump water out of a mine, you can't then stop those pumps. If the water gets back in, you rot the supports and the whole thing falls in. It becomes unsafe. And so you need a form of power that is portable. You don't need to be attached to a river, and it needs to run constantly. It can't be periodic. And so steam engines allowed you to pump out these mines, and suddenly deposits, which were still very rich and were well known since the Roman period, were accessible again. And this led to a virtuous cycle where now you have an industry building steam engines. You have a huge section of the population, or not huge, but initially, you know, a reasonable section of the population becoming trained in their manufacture and their use. And so the barrier to entry falls. You get the iterative improvements that come with building lots of something, steam engines, and suddenly that brings down the cost of its utilization everywhere else. And I think the same goes for space and rockets. And so what I'm trying to say with this whole diversion is that when it comes to space, I think that the first decisive industry is going to be delta V, in the same way that the first decisive industry was coal. I have no idea to what extent delta V is just a word to you or your audience.
Explain delta V.
So delta V is the ability to change your velocity. If you want, you can look up, there are wonderful maps of the solar system by delta V. And what they're essentially expressing is to say, to get from one orbital position to another one, how much do you need to change your velocity? So for example, right. And it's given in a velocity. So for example, to escape the surface of Earth, depending on how you measure, it's about 8 kilometers. 8 kilometers per second. You need to change your velocity by about that much to get from Earth's surface to low Earth orbit. And then to get from low Earth orbit to the surface of Mars is actually about the same.
Right. So if I'm understanding this right, and I need to circle back to finish the earlier analogy and saying, okay, what is the sort of steam engines and the coal of the current era? But just on the point of delta V, if my mental model is working correct, if I want to go from Earth to, say, Mars, I don't point my rocket straight at Mars and just start heading towards it, what I do is I wait for a suitable moment where it's going to be passing us. And then I basically, the Earth is already going around the sun, so it already has that momentum. And then I add a bit more to it so that instead of doing Earth's orbit, I end up at the orbit of Mars. And likewise, if I want to go to, say, Venus, which is a bit closer, I kind of do the opposite. I kind of take away some of the momentum that the Earth has to end up back at the so it's a kind of this series of arches. That's what you're describing with Delta V.
Exactly. You're modifying your orbit such that you get an intersect, and then you can do a capture maneuver, which is where you get close enough that the gravity of the body influences you, and then you just need to decelerate a little bit, and then you can capture yourself into a stable orbit.
Yes. So if Delta V is the steam engines of this current or the upcoming space era, what is the coal or the iron or something that I want to get hold of once I can actually go places?
So I would argue that Delta V is expressible as the means to, in the same way that coal powered steam engines, the coal of our industrial revolution in space is going to be the ways that we provide Delta V that doesn't come from the surface of Earth. Now, what do I mean by that?
So not rocket engines.
Well,
chemical reaction engines.
Well, not necessarily that. What I more mean is, so there's an expression called the tyranny of the rocket equation, because let's say you want to take a rocket from the surface of Earth to Mars, and you need to move a certain tonnage. You need to move people or cargo, let's say nuclear fuel and shelters, and that sort of thing you need to send before you send colonists.
Yes.
You have to, that has mass, and then the rocket carrying it has mass. And of course, most of your mass is fuel. If we were to take some numbers, the Starship, if it performs as well as Elon Musk says it will, it has a specific impulse of about 350, which is, it's not important, but it's a measure of how efficiently it can turn chemical energy into Delta V.
Well, explain it to this way: of the total tonnage, what percentage is the machine itself, what percentage is fuel, and what percentage is the useful stuff that you're actually doing this whole exercise for?
So, to get 150 tons of cargo, for example, and into low Earth orbit with a rocket that weighs 100 tons, you need about 2,200 tons of fuel.
Okay, wow. So it's by far most of it is the fuel.
Yes. Starship gets about 2.5% of its mass, of its launch mass to orbit. And that's better than most rockets. Okay. That's way better than most rockets. That's actually on the highest peak of performance.
Okay, so straight away, what you're suggesting is that you really, really are motivated to find a way to do space-based mining, in-situ manufacturing, so 3D printing, basically. So there's a number of problems you need to solve there. You need to solve the... Because you can't do this with humans, because you're going to be in space for such a long time that it's just not viable, and you've got more support systems. So you've got to solve the AI problem, you've got to solve the robotics problem. They've got to be able to do sort of mapping power. They've got to be able to self repair, all that kind of stuff. But once you solve that, and it doesn't feel like we're necessarily more than one human generation away from solving all of that stuff, you can then basically send mining operations off to wherever. Well, and in fact, I'll circle back in a minute to where you think they're going to go, but you could send them off to somewhere, and then they can basically start producing useful stuff in space. That's kind of what you're describing, isn't it?
Precisely. And my point is that, and it's very good you mentioned 3D printing, because the thing, unlike on Earth, where the transportation costs are a function of lots of complex things, in space, the transportation costs are essentially just a function of how much does it weigh and what's the delta V between the two orbits you need to move it.
Yes.
And so, because mass is the only thing that matters, the first thing you want to make in space is fuel, because the most of your rocket is going to end up fuel. And then you want to you move down the hierarchy. So what's the next heaviest thing? Hull sections, pieces of metal, because you don't the idea of a space dry dock, you don't need to manufacture all the parts in space. Just like on Earth, if some tin pot dictatorship wants to build, say, missiles, it doesn't need to build every component of the missile. It can just buy in some of the parts, make the basic parts, and assemble it. And that builds up a basis of skill. It creates some reinvestment, and So we might get to the point where you make all the light but difficult to make stuff on Earth, you know, microchips and circuits, and you send that up as in a rocket, and then you mate that with all the heavy but simple stuff like the hull plating and the fuel, and assemble that in a space dry dock.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. Yes. So you get your mass down significantly.
Yes.
While you're doing all of the heavy stuff. And I believe there is a company doing that. I mean, there's a company called Made in Space that are kind of pioneering this kind of stuff. They're sort of doing 3D printing, and they're aiming to sort of put orbits into space and put these payloads into space and then set up sort of lightweight manufacturing. The issue with them, of course, is that if they have to take the raw materials with them, there's no change in the total of mass that it needs to take up. But there is... Well, short term, there's a lot of space junk. There's a lot of old satellites up there that they can reuse. And longer term, if they can go to somewhere else as well, they can start making stuff in situ.
Yes.
And that allows you to then build up the space economy proper with
yes, exactly.
what you're talking about, which is dry docks. So tell us about that. Orbital manufacturing and these dry docks. What do you mean by these?
So there's an expression that if I said that a few times, but there's an expression that if you get to low Earth orbit, you're halfway to anywhere. And so,
yes,
when I say a space dry dock, I'm referring to installations or ships or, you know, just a station of any kind sitting in low Earth orbit, which can take a combination of parts and crew and personnel launched from the Earth and from other bodies and transform them into finished products. And one of the most important things is rockets that don't need to be able to enter planets. Because if you can build a rocket that doesn't need to enter planets, then you don't need the heavy heat shielding. You don't need all of these other things. You can get rid of everything that's surplus to requirement. And suddenly, rockets are much cheaper to move around because you can build something that's dedicated.
Right. And by definition, if you've taken it from the Earth, it's had to endure the Earth's atmosphere.
Exactly.
So anything you launch from Earth is not going to be as cheap as this stuff could be able to. So if you can get your in-situ manufacturing going, you can produce very cheap system-to-system transport.
Exactly. And it also lets you use engines that are more efficient than chemical rockets. Because on Earth, for example, there's a concept that we've tested pretty well called a nuclear thermal engine. So in a chemical rocket, you're igniting an oxidizer and a fuel, and they are creating high temperature, high-pressure gas that is expelled. In a nuclear thermal engine, you instead have a nuclear reactor on your rocket, and it's got a tank of hydrogen, and the heat from the reactor heats the hydrogen to a far higher temperature than a chemical reaction could. And so it accelerates it much greater. It produces much more thrust for a certain amount of mass. But the problem is, because of that big, heavy nuclear reactor, it's very hard to make one of those that has enough impulse to actually get off the surface of the Earth. But in space, it doesn't matter if it takes 10 years to burn from one orbit to the other, if you're only using a small amount of fuel. And so suddenly, instead of needing to be 90% fuel, you can have an engine that's quite weak, but because you don't have to overcome gravity and escape a body, it doesn't matter that it's quite weak. It's you have a very efficient engine. And again, that brings down fuel costs. It lets you get experience with certain technologies. A good example of just how bad this gets is, I mentioned earlier, Mars is about the same delta V to get from Earth, from low Earth orbit to Mars is the same to get from Earth's surface to low Earth orbit. It's about 8 kilometers per second in either case. And so you might assume then...
Interesting.
You might assume then that, okay, let's say we want to get that 150-ton payload we talked about earlier with a 100-ton rocket, and we need to get that to the surface of Mars. Well, that means we have to carry the amount of fuel that we needed at the beginning, that 2,000 tons. We need 2,200 tons of fuel in orbit, so you can treat that as a payload. So if it took 2,200 tons to get 250 tons in orbit, how much is it going to take to get 2,500 tons into low Earth orbit? You need to carry all that fuel.
Yeah, so you're going to have to do, you know, 10, 12 runs just to get the fuel to then do the other half of the trip.
Exactly. And so this is why I'm saying the profit margins are widest for a fuel station, because in that example I gave, you would need 15 launches just to get enough fuel up. And so let's say SpaceX is charging $50 million a launch. Well, if they need to do 16 launches to get a payload into space, and the competitor says, well, just launch your small rocket, refuel up here, then the competitor can charge upward the cost of 15 launches and it still will be cheaper. So there's an enormous profit margin to be made there.
I see. Yes. Okay. Because, I mean, SpaceX are kind of dominating at the moment, aren't they? But they're doing something like 90% of the launches. But as you say, it's wide open for competition. In fact, I bought a company recently. I bought Rocket Labs. couple of months back. I don't know if you know anything about them. I don't know too much about them. All I know is that they're a rocket company based in New Zealand that was valued at about $2 billion that is successfully putting payloads in orbit. And I looked at them and I thought, well, it can't be a £2 billion company, because I'm seeing AI companies that come up and they say, oh, we're planning to do something with AI at some point in the future, but we don't have a product, and they get a valuation of $2 billion. And this thing is actually putting payloads in orbit. In fact, I'll just check it now to see how it's doing. It's $5 billion now. I've more than doubled my money. That's how we like to do it. That's one example of, you know, a whole suite of companies that are now operating on this basis. Are there any that you also have got your eye on? Because, I mean, there are some big names amongst them, aren't there?
Well, so, of course, you've got Elon Musk. But Elon Musk is in an interesting position where he's sort of in the same position as Bell Labs. You know, Bell Labs had the advantage of it. It possessed the entire telephone market of America. But it, despite it having this enormous research budget, it actually wasn't incentivized to push forward telephones because, you know, it by advancing telephones, it would create its own competitors. Musk is in a position where he makes the most money by doing the opposite. Instead of trying to create fuel in space, he's trying to lower the cost per launch. So Elon Musk is in the best position to do it, but weirdly, he has the least incentive because he makes his money based on the total number of launches. So I would bet that it would probably be an up-and-coming second-place runner who works in competition with SpaceX, and after they do manage to succeed at all, they get purchased by SpaceX, you know, something on those margins.
Which will just inspire more competition.
Yeah, exactly. Because, of course, once you've got the first space gas station, getting the second one is far cheaper, and the third one, and the fourth one. And so it becomes much more practicable for competitors to emerge, and you still have this enormous profit margin. And so what happens eventually is you start to get a market in space. And once you have a market up there, instead of every good needing to get either from Earth to an orbit or from an orbit to Earth, now you have exchanges between orbits, and you have, and essentially everything is expressible. Every mission profile, be it putting an observatory on a Centaur comet or anything like that, can be expressed as a tolerance of acceleration. Is it basically, does it have people on board? How much does it weigh, and how much delta V do you need to move? Every mission can be expressed like that. And if you can bring down the cost of the delta V, then you can move more tonnage for a given dollar.
Well, incidentally, then you could easily put that on a commodities trading market as well, because if it's expressible for a few simple terms, you can develop a futures market around it as well.
Yes.
And then it becomes very reliable because firms can say, okay, well, I need this much payload in space, or I need this much moved from this orbit to this much, or I need this this amount of data processing to be produced up there and then shipped to this orbit and so on. And you can kind of forward plan it, finance it, build your business plans around it, and then it becomes, it's like the coffee or the orange juice industry. It's just,
exactly,
just get it done.
Exactly.
Remarkable. Okay, so Starlink, obviously, my little Rocket Labs, which hopefully is going to be a decent competitor. You've got Starlink as well as SpaceX. I think Starlink is still a part of SpaceX. But you've got Amazon, who are working on their project Kuiper, I think it's called. They're putting sort of satellites up there as well. You've got OneWeb, who are sort of doing the same sort of thing as well. So in all of these areas, you can see a network of firms are starting to emerge to provide that marketplace that you're talking about.
Exactly. And right now we're at the stage of very early steam engines, where initially steam engines were only useful to pump out mines, but because that belt experience, eventually that opened other doors, because what's happened is the number of people who are building rockets, the number of firms, the number of people is growing. And as a result, launch costs are falling. And as launch costs fall, getting the equipment to mine up in space gets cheaper. Because you asked earlier, where do you think this will happen? I think the first candidate is Luna, because of all of the kinds of delta V you can make in space, the obvious one is you take water ice, you melt it, you electrolyze it into hydrogen and water, rocket fuel, chemical rocket fuel.
Okay.
Mars,
and the water is easy enough to find on Mars, on the moon, and
at the poles, yes, and it's also available in minerals. A little known fact is that, for example, on Mars, most of the water of the primordial oceans isn't frozen or escaped; it's silted over. So that is to say that there are lots of minerals which, as bodies of water evaporate, trap water in them, evaporites, we call them. So when water is evaporating, one of the very first minerals that condenses out is a mineral called gypsum. And gypsum has H2O actually locked up in its chemical structure. We have huge amounts of gypsum on Mars. It's one of the most common minerals. And you can denature the water out by simply heating it in a kiln, and it escapes the steam.
Okay. Well, that's pretty simple.
Yeah, exactly. And unlike water ice, you don't have the problem of volatile contaminants. And some really interesting ones is that, for example, on Venus has very little water in the atmosphere, but the water in the atmosphere is way more concentrated in deuterium. There's way more heavy water, 600 times more heavy water in the atmosphere of Venus per molecule of water than on Earth. And so that's how you start to get the more exotic products.
I mean, while we're speaking about Venus, you didn't happen to catch my little podcast on colonizing Venus, did you? Where I was sort of arguing with Bo.
I did.
I was kind of arguing for the sake of it because he was so keen on Mars. But how did I do in terms of planetary science?
Very good. I really liked how you pointed out that getting from Venus to any other orbit is actually easier than, for example, because if you build a mining base on Mars, intuitively we think, well, that's closer to the asteroid belt. But on average, an asteroid from Mars can be a very long distance away. And so gravitationally, it doesn't really quite matter so much that you're proximal in your orbit, because the closer you are to the sun, the lower your average distance is to everything. There's a wonderful trick you can pull on people when you ask, what is the nearest planet to Earth on average?
Venus, I would guess.
Mercury.
Yes.
Exactly. And that's actually true of every single body in the solar
system. It is, isn't it? Yes.
Exactly. Because, yes, our closest approach is to Venus, but that doesn't matter very much because on average, Venus can also end up on the other side of the sun. And so
you didn't ask for the absolute closest, you asked for the closest average.
Exactly.
Which, of course, yes, of course, is going to be Mercury.
Yes.
Okay. So we probably start with a lot. We are starting right now with a lot of low Earth orbit stuff.
Yeah.
The next logical progression from that is to go to the moon, because you need materials. You particularly need water, and you can find it there at the poles, as you say. And presumably lunar regolith can be turned into something useful. I mean, I know you can actually turn it into solar panels. They're very low efficiency solar panels, but because it's already there, you're willing to accept like 5% of the efficiency you get on an Earth-made solar panel, because all the raw materials are there. It's just a question of building them up. So we talked about what the low Earth orbit economy is starting to look like. What would the economy of the moon start to look like when that gets rolling?
Well, I would say that there are integral steps together, because of course you can't manufacture fuel in low Earth orbit without a source of raw material from somewhere. I think the moon makes the most sense as that raw material. So I think that the very first economic activity on the moon will be to support that kind of low Earth orbit gas station. Because the delta V to get from the surface of the moon to low Earth orbit is tiny compared to the amount it needs to take off from Earth. Mm-hmm. And so if you mine, say, 100 kilograms of ice on the moon, and importantly, then refine it there so you're not carrying all the weight of useless rock, the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. So you can put that in a tank, fire it out of a railgun or a chemical gun, or just use a traditional rocket, it doesn't matter, and then carry that to low Earth orbit and sell it there for an enormous profit. And on
touch on railguns, because they're interesting as well.
Yeah.
Because if I got this vaguely right, sort of electro-propelled, basically big sled, get it up into space, and then it basically takes itself and then finds itself in low Earth orbit, and then you just come along and pick it up. Is that right?
What you do is you fire it such that it becomes gravitationally influenced by the Earth, and it would normally whiplash around, but then you just have a small little rocket that goes and slows it down just a tiny bit at the aphelion, and then you can do a stabilization burn.
So you sort of fire these sleds from the moon, full of processed water, or you could have already cracked it into hydrogen and oxygen if you wanted.
Exactly.
And then, so you're basically supplying your gas station from the moon.
Yeah.
In low Earth orbit.
And in that case, all of the propulsion doesn't need to go with the payload, because it's just electricity. So you generate that locally. You put some solar panels down and you can generate. And so you don't need to carry delta V. The rocket equation can't touch you because you're not burning anything. You just fire the slug and you then manufacture another slug and fire another one.
So the only thing you really need to take up from Earth at that point is particularly clever stuff.
Exactly.
So let's say 90% or 90 plus percent of your, or whatever you send from the Earth is going to be consumed in fuel and the ship itself.
Yeah.
You really want to focus that down on very sensitive, very complicated electronics or humans.
Exactly.
And their food. And then kind of everything else you're manufacturing up there. And then you're going on to the next stage of whatever comes after that stage.
Exactly. It's a hierarchy of mass, which is, first of all, how well does its manufacturing scale? So there are certain manufacturing processes which are relatively efficient at any scale, like brick making. If you have a large brick factory or a small brick factory, you'll produce about the same amount per kiln. But a small electronics workshop is going to produce far less than a large electronics factory. Because of the nature of microchips. And microchips are pretty hard to make in orbit. Actually, they have some advantages, yes, too. Additive manufacturing might actually be easier in a zero-G environment, but that's a question.
Not enough to overcome the economies of scale of doing it on Earth.
Exactly. Especially since most manufacturing processes actually decrease mass, so sending up raw material is going to weigh more than just sending up finished products.
So what is at the opposite end of that equation? I mean, fuel, presumably,
sure,
is at the other end of the equation.
And then heavy hull plating, stainless steel, for example.
Okay.
So the first...
Anything basic and heavy.
Yes, exactly. Because then what you can do is, a bit like Vickers, you can essentially just build sections of hull plating. Vickers in the late 19th, early 20th century was famous for this. Just build huge sections of ships and then sell them. Go around the world and see if anyone was interested in buying them. It's why when World War I kicked off, British shipyards were building warships for like Brazil, Paraguay, and the Ottoman Empire.
So we've got now a fairly sophisticated low Earth orbit economy,
yes,
gas stations, we've got data centers,
dry docks.
Presumably, you know, companies like Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic are now operating up there. They're taking tourists up. We've got our lunar base, which is providing manufacturing of fuel and heavy components and stuff like that. What's the moon like in terms of other stuff than ice? What if I want to get, I don't know, iron, nickel, lithium?
So a bit like on Earth, the problem isn't necessarily the amount, the presence of a particular material. It's down to concentration. If you were to a good example of this is seawater. There's more gold dissolved in the ocean seawater than has ever been mined on Earth. But because the volume of water is enormous, trying to sift it for that concentration isn't economical. On the moon, you can find traces of metals pretty easily. It's just coming down to, are you going to find ores? And the trouble with that is that the things that create ores on Earth are a large number of processes that require an atmosphere and a hydrosphere. So again, an example of this is placer deposits. A placer deposit is where you get a situation where uranium. Most of the uranium on Earth comes from placer deposits where you have water flowing and uranium, small uranium particles, which are present in volcanic rocks. They're brought up from the mantle. They are heavier by mass. And so when water is dispersing, the uranium is heaviest and drops first. And then that over millions of years builds up a sandstone that's rich in uranium. It's naturally concentrated. Other environments are where you have water that is enriched. You have water moving through a rhyolitic stone. It becomes enriched in gold ions. That then moves through a less oxidizing environment. The gold reacts and falls out of solution. That's why veins look like flows of water.
I see. Okay, so that's something I hadn't really considered before, but a living planet is crucial for its geological development. The actual living element of it and the water flow and all the rest of it, that is crucial in of itself. That we shouldn't necessarily expect to find on something like the moon, which has never had life. Well, you can address that point. But and then I'm wondering, okay, well, what about Venus and Mars, which we might reasonably have assumed at some point in the past may have had ocean and a, you know, some proto ecology system.
Well, one of the
address those. How does that work on the moon and then our closest neighbors?
So the iron is the one we named, and this is where we really get picked off, because iron, rather than just needing hydrosphere specifically on Earth's case, needs ice. Needs life. Most of our iron comes from something called a banded iron formation, which is where you have microbes on Earth that were taking iron ions and building them up. And so you can get these enormous layers, meters and meters thick, of iron chert, iron chert, iron chert. And these were assembled over millions of years. And this is where like 85% of our iron ore comes from. There are other sources of iron ore that don't need life, but they're much less concentrated, much less common. So on the moon and on Mars, on the moon and Mars, I'll start with first, we have reason to believe they have a similar geological model, which is called stagnant lid, where there the primordial heat trapped by a body is not enough, and the radioactive decay is not enough to keep the lid mobile. And so active volcanism stops. The mantle heat is not producing enough heat that it breaks through and tries to get to the surface, as opposed to Earth, where we have a tectonic lid. Where
is that largely a function of their smaller size?
Yes, and the lack of metal and their lower metallicity.
Okay.
Because of course, as you know, that as a sphere gets larger, its volume increases more rapidly than its surface area.
Yes.
And so, on Earth, our larger size means that we trapped a lot more heat during formation, primordial heat, and we also have a lot more heavy elements that are undergoing radiometric decay and generating heat inside the planet. And so, on Earth, that's why we still have active volcanism. There isn't active volcanism on Venus. There isn't active volcanism on the Moon. There isn't active volcanism on Mars or the Moon, but on Venus, as of 3 months ago, we've proved there's active volcanism.
Yes, I understand it's got more volcanoes than anywhere else in the solar system.
We're not sure. In terms of total volcanic structures, yes. But with regards to living volcanoes, we've only just found one thus far. We found, because Venus is very hard to study on the surface because of its thick atmosphere.
Yes, it's a bit cloudy.
Well, yes. And so we needed to, when we were surveying it, use something that had a high enough wavelength that it wasn't going to interfere with the atmosphere of CO2. So we used radio waves. But radio waves are enormous compared to visible light, and so the resolution is very poor. So if you were to study, for example, a mountain on Venus, that might only be 1 or 2 pixels. We've had a very hard time learning about the surface of Venus. And also, since the Soviets went there, we've invested almost nothing in exploring it. Venus has been really neglected because people saw it as a hell world. And we said, well, there's not life there. It's just a big ball of rock, CO2, basaltic minerals. Why would we expect anything to be of value there? And so finding out that unlike every other planet in the solar system that we know, it didn't just have historical volcanism, but volcanism is still going on. And it's not like Io, where it's driven by tidal heating. It's actually Earth-like volcanism. That is a big discovery, and that has inspired a lot of active investigation.
And so my idea that I discussed in that podcast of, well, you just put a cloud city up there, and you float above the clouds, and then you use, again, sort of in-situ 3D printing and robots and stuff. You send them down, you stick them under a dome, and you heat vent it. Is that viable?
With regards to human habitation, that's probably the only way you would want to try and do it without the sort of terraforming that you can only do once you've won the game of civilization, once resource scarcity just no longer exists. Because at that level, first of all, the delta V to get from the surface of Venus to orbit is 3 times the delta V to get off the surface of Earth because of the incredibly thick atmosphere. Venus also, because of its incredibly slow and retrograde rotation, it's rotating the wrong way around and incredibly slowly, doesn't give you a gravitational assist getting into an orbit.
That's interesting. Okay, so Venus obviously has, you know, 90% of the gravity that the Earth has.
Yes.
So you'd think that it'd be easier getting off the surface, but the bit of the atmospheric drag, which is a much smaller part on Earth, becomes a hugely significant factor, presumably, than in Venus.
Yes, on the surface.
And also, the other thing you do on Earth is you launch as close as you can to the equator, because that spin of the Earth It doesn't give you much, but every little helps. It
gives you about 20%
when you're dealing with that. And that helps you get off. But of course, yeah, so Venus has the thick atmosphere and the spin goes the wrong way. So it doesn't help you at all. So everything is... So the surface is a bit of a bitch.
It absolutely is. But yeah. the weird side factor of that is there is a resource on the surface which doesn't need geology to be concentrated, which is very exciting, which is silica. Silica, we know that the Venusian crust is rich in silica. It's covered in basaltic rock, which can be like 50 to 70% silica by weight. And if you have silica and you have hydrogen, which you can get from the sulfuric acid clouds, you can make silane. And silane burns in CO2. It can CO2 and silane burn on their own. CO2 can be a oxidizer to silane, which means you can get craft which burn, a bit like on Earth, when you have a jet engine, unlike a rocket, it doesn't need to also carry an oxidizer. On Earth, the reason a plane is more efficient than a rocket is because it can get its oxidizer, oxygen, from the atmosphere. But a rocket needs to carry both. Well, if you have a silane-based propulsion system, there's an enormous disadvantage, which is you can probably only use them once. But the advantage is you don't need to carry the oxidizer. The reason you probably can only use them once is one of those products is solid. It's silica crystals.
And so hang on. It's not clear to me what the useful takeaway from this is. I mean, is this going to give you propulsion within the atmosphere of Venus or more broadly than that?
It would give you a way to go from your cloud city to low Venusian orbit without spending an arm and a leg. You can use a rocket plane.
Ah.
And because of the relative buoyancy, you can float on Venus at 50 kilometers up incredibly easily. The CO2 is much denser, and because hydrogen doesn't burn in it, you can get enormous buoyancy forces. And so if you take off from 50 kilometers up, you get to avoid the incredibly thick atmosphere. In fact, the atmospheric drag is slightly less than Earth. And you by not needing to carry an oxidizer, and because of the lower mass, if we can get jet planes working on Earth, that is to say a craft that can get you to orbit and then you have a rocket meet it, that's a much cheaper launch. And it's easier to get working.
That's what they call that a jet plane, do they?
It's one term for it. There's also space plane.
That's basically a jet that will get you into low orbit.
Well, not orbit specifically, but orbital altitude. And then you can have a rendezvous with a craft that then picks you up and then you skim back into the atmosphere.
Okay, and then you use a bit of rocket thrust in order to do that last bit.
Yes, exactly.
So you skim back. But presumably that would be significantly easier on Venus because of the density of the atmosphere.
It's because the atmosphere is easier on Venus for a number of reasons. First of all, even though silane has a relatively low specific impulse and you can only use it once, because you can because it can be used at any altitude in the Venusian atmosphere, you can use that to communicate resources from the surface to your sky city and from your sky city to low Earth orbit where it meets with a rocket. And then that rocket can go off into the solar system. The reason that's important is because Venus is very good for supporting the second and third stages of space industry because it has abundant sulfur. It has abundant carbon. It has a lot of resources, which sulfur especially is not common in the asteroid belt. It's kind of hard to find it. And if you want to make electronics, you cannot go without sulfuric acid. So if you have a planet that has clouds of it,
right,
that sulfuric acid is an enormous resource.
Well, and presumably it's also useful for leaching any other materials that you gather from the asteroid belt.
Leaching is exactly the word for it. That's actually the term in ore processing. Because if you have an asteroid, instead of needing to drill it, imagine if you build a space station that's rotating. You know the concept in sci-fi where you generate an artificial gravity by spinning? Instead,
you have a sphere and you have a cylinder and then you spin it and you're on the inside of the cylinder.
Yes.
And you stick to the outside, like those old fashioned fairground rides that spin around and then go up.
Exactly. You can do the same thing where you fill it. You crush an asteroid. You take big chunks of an asteroid, crush it, and then inject high temperature CO2, and the minerals will simply be the valuable material will be leached out by the centrifugal forces. It'll differentially separate because of the higher mass.
So actually, Venus is very, very viable for that phase that we're talking about, which is going to be the key driver, which is the gas station bit.
Exactly.
And the support for the other stuff. So we've now got our low Earth orbit stuff. We've got our moon base. That then gets us to Venus, and it gives us all of the things you've just talked about that support fleshing out that industry significantly, which then enables us to go to the asteroid belt. And with the resources that we took from Venus via the moon, via Earth, we can then start, well, basically we have, not unlimited, but from our perspective right now, almost unlimited amounts of useful metals and other stuff that if our in situ, our 3D printing is sufficiently developed to that point, I mean, you could start building pretty much anything you want.
Exactly.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.